Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 7 of The Drop Set. I am Darren Starr, your host and entertainment for the next, I'm going to go ahead and guess 40 minutes. I do outline these things in advance, but I have no idea how long they're going to end up taking. It took last week off. Just had a bunch of stuff, and with the new year and whatnot, I figured I might get a little bit of a pass. I don't know. But here we are. We're back this week. So what's changed in the last 2 weeks? What is new? Just been keeping busy, working with clients, writing stuff, trying to stay active on social media as best I can, all that good stuff. I did put up a new blog post. It was just yesterday, and the topic was strategies for training legs. So basically what I'm asking people to do is take your picks, take a good long look at them, and assess how well your leg training as it's set up right now, or maybe for the past year or two, has been working for you. And don't be afraid to make some changes. And in that post, I also offer some options as far as, if you're training legs once a week and you want to upgrade to hitting them twice a week or multiple times a week, how you might go about doing that, what some of those sessions might look like, how you might split them up and that kind of stuff. So check it out. If you go to 5starphysique.com, it's right at the top of the page, or at least it'll be close to it. By the time you're listening to this, there will be a post above it that has this podcast. So let's see, what else has been going on? I caught a couple movies, strangely enough, which I always see that. I'm one of those people who, you see a commercial for a movie and you're like, oh my God, I've got to see that. That's going on the list. And then before you know it, it's out of the theaters and there you go. So I'm not great socially in getting out and going to do stuff all the time. But I did happen to see Rogue One again for the second time. Took the wife this time and had to explain a little bit to her. She is not a giant Star Wars fan. So it was kind of like, wait, who are these people again? Why do we care? That kind of stuff. And I don't blame her at all. I mean, I'm a huge Star Wars geek. I have been since I knew what movies were. But if you're not, it's still good stuff. But you can't go into it without any kind of a background and expect to know what's going on. They say, well, it's a standalone film. Yeah, but you've got to kind of know a little bit about the universe and what's going on. I also saw Arrival, which was the Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner movie about the aliens that land on Earth and how the hell do we communicate with these creatures. And it was fantastic. I mean, a totally different experience from something like Rogue One. This is a lot more cerebral. Dare I say, I almost liked it more. I'm a big fan of those kind of things. Movies like 2001, Interstellar to some extent, the sci-fi genre that focuses on, conflict and storytelling and, the science aspect of things more than the sensationalized, space battles and stuff blown up and stuff like that. Anyway, there you go. I did always say back when I was in my early 20s, I wanted to grow up and be a movie critic. That didn't pan out, but this may be a recurring segment here. I know a lot of you are probably thinking right now, God, I hope not. So, that's what's new. Anyway, the Q&A this week, it'll be a brief one. And it was just a question that came in today from a client, and it was a good question, and it's one that doesn't really have an obvious answer. So just wanted to talk about that briefly here. The question was, okay, I've got my macros. Now I am over or under on my carbs for this day. Do I make that up the next day? And the answer to that is maybe. It kind of depends. It depends on where you are in your prep and what the next day entails. For example, if you are 3 weeks out from your show, first of all, you shouldn't be missing your numbers at all. And if the next day is a rest day and you were short on your carbs, do you add those carbs in the next day? I'm going to say probably not, but it kind of depends. We need to look at the situation and make a decision. In general, though, you can really get lost in the process of trying to micromanage your caloric intake. I saw a post or a write-up from somebody. Who was it? Milo Sarchev, I think it was, years back. And his breakdown was basically, look at how long you're awake and take your caloric intake and divide that into like an hourly basis and, basically just titrate your nutrients out through the day so that they're, fairly evenly dispensed throughout the day. That is a real, real micromanager's approach. Is it wrong? Not necessarily. Is it difficult? Well, it's certainly more involved. The opposite of that being something like, hey, you know what, your carbs are 200 grams a day, and it's the same for all days, so basically you're looking at 1,400 grams a week. So as long as you get 1,400 grams a week, we don't really care about the highs and the lows, whatever, just hit the total for the week, and it'll all average out to be where we need it to be. Yeah, that's a little too laissez-faire for my taste. I don't like that. That opens up the door for saying, okay, I'm going to have 500 grams here, 500 grams here, and then I'm going to have, you know, 75 grams a day for the next 5 days or whatever. You know, it's like, yeah, why don't we even some things out? It doesn't really take into account, you know, the cyclical nature of, you know, rest days versus training days. You know, if you wanted a carb cycle so that you're taking in more on leg days, et cetera. You know, all those things are valid. Just taking those two examples to illustrate the extreme ends, the truth is usually somewhere in the middle. So it kind of depends on how over you are. Like if your daily carb intake is 100 and you have a day at 200, I don't typically find there's a lot of value in trying to keep it at zero the next day to make up. I might say split the difference and say, all right, let's cut it down to 60 for the next day or something like that. Let's take a little bit of a dive. Again, it's so dependent on the situation. If you're in a growth phase and you go over on your carbs, I'd say, cool, mission accomplished. Great. Do not try and go under the next day to account for that. So, and that was the situation I was presented with here, where the client who emailed me, we are in a growth phase right now. So like, nah, don't make it up. You know, don't try and cut it short or anything like that. We're just going to keep on rolling. So it is a question that comes up a lot, though, and people they think about it and then they overthink about it. And the moral of the story is, as with most things, it depends, which feels like such a cop-out of an answer, but it really does. It really does. This week's bodybuilding myth, we have a good one here. And that is that in bodybuilding, you should always stick with free weights. This is patently stupid. I'm not going to sugarcoat it and say, well, you know, maybe. No, it's dumb. What you need to do is stick with exercises that work your muscles, and whether that is with free weights or machine or no weight, body weight, resistance bands, TRX, whatever, it's all good. Everything works as long as you work it with the appropriate intensity. So people will say, well, you know, movements on a machine, you know, the machine does the stabilization for you, and it doesn't, you don't have to use your stabilizer muscles. And I just smack people upside the head right there and say, what exactly the fuck is a stabilizer muscle? I'm pretty sure every muscle is a stabilizer muscle. So that whole notion of, you know, like, you have to do exercises while standing on a Bosu ball because that helps your balance and that works your stabilizer muscles. The specificity principle, which is one of the bedrocks of personal training, says in order to get better at something, you do that thing. So doing an exercise on a Bosu ball makes you better at doing an exercise on a Bosu ball. It doesn't help with stability. It doesn't improve your balance or anything like that. You'll feel it a little bit differently, sure. But this notion of, you know, you've got to use free weights or you've got to put yourself in an unstable atmosphere so that you can work stabilizer muscles is just hokum. There's nothing to it. Nothing to it. Now, that being said, you can find all kinds of bodybuilders who have been really successful who have stuck with the basics, barbell, dumbbell exercises, and that's it. You can find probably a lot more that have not limited themselves to a particular mode of exercise and will use everything at their disposal, whatever helps. So machines are great because, you know, you don't need a spotter for a machine. You can focus like on a shoulder press, for example. With a barbell shoulder press, you do have to be concerned about the travel of that bar path. And so your brain has a lot to think about, a lot to worry about. There's a lot of tasks for it to perform and be concerned with. In a machine, you just get under that thing and you push it up. That's all there is to it. So you can focus a lot more on what the shoulder is doing and less about trying to impart stability into the bar. So there are values both ways. When I do exercise programming, I do everything except BOSU balls. I don't do that. Okay, so that brings us to our two main topics. The last podcast that we did, I talked about, you know, how you go about searching for a coach, and I wanted to follow up on that with like a part B, basically. And this one is, you know, coaching expectations and roles. What are you expecting a coach to do for you, and are those expectations based in reality? And then once you define that, how does that influence how you search for a coach? And once again, I am partial to this because I am a coach, and I think, you know, in putting this podcast out here, I want to help people who might be in the market for a coach, looking for one, thinking about one. I want to help them in their search, and whether that leads them to me or somebody else, I mean, whatever. You need to find the coach that's the best fit for you. I don't claim to be the best fit for everybody, and if you have a coach that does, they're full of shit, because they're not. You know, everybody has their strengths and weaknesses, so this segment here is to help, you know, identify the categories of ways in which a coach can help you, and then identify what's important to you, and then how you can use that to find a coach that's appropriate for you. So why do you need a coach at all? Well, first of all, maybe you don't. A lot of people find, you know, the accountability, the certitude of it. So, you know, when you're coming up with your own macros, your own routine, there's always that question of, am I doing the right thing? Maybe I should do this instead. You hire a coach, it's not your concern. You can be part of the discussion, absolutely. I mean, I encourage that with my clients. You know, do we know if this is best for you? Well, ask me and I'll explain my reasoning. But some people can get by just fine without a coach. For a lot of people though, understanding your own limitations and your own lack of objectivity when it comes to your own body. And most of us have that, not all of us, but most of us have that. We don't look at ourselves fairly. You know, we're going to look at ourselves and be like, hey, my legs are awesome. And so you just, you know, you train them once every other week. Whereas, you know, a coach might say, hey, your legs need to come up. We're going to train those suckers twice a week. That kind of thing. And then also just, you know, having somebody who's done this with a lot of people before and has guided them through the process. So, you know, whatever hand holding is necessary, coming up with the programming, the changes along the way, et cetera, to make sure that you're ready for whatever the target is, whether it's a show, a photo shoot, or anything else. So what are the roles that a coach can fulfill? The first one and the most important one, as far as I'm concerned, is that of a teacher slash educator. That is the definition of a coach, really. I mean, they're teaching you how to do something. So I take that role very seriously. You'll find a lot of people who call themselves coaches when they're really just program writers. They're not interested in explaining anything to you. If you don't already know it, go look it up. You're on your own, but here's your plan. And that's fine. Just understand who those people are, and understand if maybe that's what you need. Maybe you don't need to be taught everything. I think if you think, you know, if you feel like you don't need to be taught anything, that you know everything already, you probably don't understand, you know, how big the forest is. So there's a lot to learn, a lot. And a coach should be willing to teach you along the way. And so this means, you know, if you are a rank beginner, your coach should be able to help you get familiar with the gym, comfortable with the equipment, improve your proficiency with the basics, teaching you how to squat, how to do a correct deadlift, that kind of stuff. Doing that, you know, assuming you have a knowledgeable coach, doing that in person is really easy. Doing it online is a little bit harder and it takes a little bit more interaction, but it's still absolutely doable. So, you know, explaining the process along the way of, okay, here are the macros. This is why they're set up this way. You know, when I work with somebody, I don't try to keep everything in a black box to improve my, improve my longevity and my ability to keep somebody as a client for longer. You know, my goal is that I'm going to continue working with new people, and existing clients will eventually go on their own, or, you know, mission accomplished and they stop, whatever. So I don't say, you know, I'm trying to get clients for life or anything like that. You know, my goal is absolutely to teach you so that you can do some of this on your own. And a lot of people, you know, they want to compete once, maybe twice, and then they want to know enough so that they can maybe not compete again, but keep themselves in reasonable shape. And if you don't learn along the way, you're going to have a tough time doing that. You know, a lot of people, they have this notion where you can train like a beast and you can diet like a mofo and you can do cardio all day long. You get ready for your show and then boom, great. It's done. We did it. Awesome. We're cool. All right. Now I'm just going to go into maintenance, and maintenance means I'm not going to do anything. That's what a lot of people think maintenance is. I'm just going to stop going to the gym. I'm going to stop following any kind of a structured diet or plan or anything like that. And I'm just going to maintain. That is not how it works. That is not reality. And so a good coach, a teacher will be able to, you know, help put you on that path and get things set so that you know what the expectations are once the coaching relationship has ended. A strategist. A coach is also a good strategist. So just like in team sports, you know, your manager in baseball is going to be working on substitutions, the lineup, et cetera, matchups, you know, pitching matchups, et cetera. In football, your head coach is going to be your game manager, your clock manager, hopefully, working substitutions there as well. You know, with a bodybuilding coach, it's very similar. There needs to be an overarching strategy behind things. The minutiae that you would find in a team sport doesn't really exist here, but there needs to be a big picture. You know, what are we doing? What is the plan? You know, if you zoom out and look at it over the course of several years, what is the plan? You know, if somebody has ambitious plans like, you know, I want to put on 50 pounds of muscle and I want to be 4% body fat, and currently they are, you know, 40 pounds overweight and have no appreciable muscle mass whatsoever. So how do we get there? What's the strategy? What's the, you know, if we were going to sketch that out in pencil, what does that look like over the course of the next handful of years? So a good coach should be able to help you strategize for that stuff. Now, also, I mean, the nuts and bolts of being a coach, the most basic and universal and fundamental role of a coach. Well, I mean, I think actually being a teacher is probably the most fundamental role. But the thing that people think of and expect when they hire a coach is a programmer. You know, somebody who can write the programming for them, somebody who can come up with a diet, a set of macronutrients, a training protocol, tell them what cardio to do, what supplements to take, and all that kind of stuff. You're not going to find too many coaches who will focus on the other stuff and then leave that part alone. You're more likely to find a lot of programmers and a lot of plan writers out there that don't focus on the other things. So just be aware that's one of the functions of a coach. But, you know, in my list here, I've got six, and that's one of them. So a good coach should also be a boundary pusher. I say that and that sounds kind of inappropriate, but I don't mean it like that. I mean, identifying somebody's comfort level and then kind of giving them a little bit of a push through that. The process of getting your body to change and respond in an aesthetic way should not necessarily be super comfortable all the time. You know, during a growth phase, you're going to have to eat a fair bit, and it might not always be super comfortable. During a cutting phase, you're going to be at a caloric deficit. You're going to be hitting cardio. It's going to stretch your time management skills a little bit. It's not always going to be easy and comfortable. The workouts should consistently be uncomfortable. You know, you need to, a good coach needs to understand how we can push a boundary without impeding on the next role. And the next role is that of a success facilitator, which this sounds like something out of like a personal improvement seminar at this point. But a success facilitator, what I mean by that is, you know, I could have the best plan in the world and I'm like, this is exactly what you need to do. Great. You're just getting started. Here you go. And then that person quits 4 days later because it was not written with their lack of experience in mind. It's too hardcore, it's too restrictive, whatever the problems may be. That is a coach that did not facilitate someone's success in following a plan. Now, some people, this is from experience, some people, their success simply cannot be facilitated, simply because something like this, you've got to want it. And a lot of people, for a lot of people, it's really easy to say that they want it, but when it comes time to actually do it, not so much. So you've got to be able to realize that, you know, I like to facilitate success. I can't make it happen. But I can put somebody in a situation where they are a little bit more advantaged towards having things work out the way that they want. So that means, you know, keeping their long-term health in mind. So not trying to run them into the ground and kill their metabolism and, you know, bring up a massive case of adrenal fatigue right off the bat or anything like that. You know, keep the caloric deficits reasonable. But understand someone's level of experience. If this is somebody's, you know, first time through, I'm going to treat them a little bit different than somebody who's done three or four shows and has competed at the national level and knows what's involved. Now we're just going to try and intensify it a little bit. They know what the path looks like. Now we're just going to pave it a little bit differently. But for somebody the first time through, I need to do a little bit of an assessment on them the first couple weeks. So whenever I bring on a new client, I always bring them in what's called an adaptation phase, and that's where they can adapt to me and I can adapt to them. So it's a learning phase, and that usually takes a couple weeks. We're figuring out the nuts and bolts of the programming, you know, the syntax and the formatting of everything, all that stuff. And also, you know, just seeing how their body responds initially to the initial diet, the initial training load, the volume, et cetera. And then I need to get a sense for, okay, I'm asking you to do this. Are you able to do it? Where are the difficulties going to be? Is this something that you are currently or can be successful at? Or do we need to reevaluate some things? Do we need to talk about, you know, a level of commitment, a level of sacrifice? Or is it one of those things where actually, you know, I can't do all this. I can do a little bit less and I'm okay with adjusting the timeline on our goal a little bit. You know, I mean, being able to work with somebody and facilitate success on terms that are agreeable to both of you is really important. The final role of a coach is that of therapist, and it is my least favorite role to play because it is the one that I am the worst at. And I hear from a lot of clients who, you know, they'll send me something, just what's on their mind, where they're struggling, why, what's going on in their personal life, just to try and explain a bad week or something like that. And, you know, I'll respond with, you know, something that's from the heart and hopefully helpful. And I get responses back from people a lot of the time saying, that is exactly what I needed to hear. Thank you. And it's not that I'm really so good at that. I do feel I am fairly empathetic. I understand, you know, what a lot of people are going through for sure. And I always try to treat people as humans and not just say, oh, well, that's all well and good, but you know what? Buck up, soldier, and fucking do it. You know, that's not super helpful. Sometimes it is, but not usually. I think a lot of times it's just, you know, somebody, they need a sounding board. And, you know, I never wanted to be that kind of trainer who in the gym, they had a couch so that their client could sit on the couch during their session and just talk to me while I held a clipboard. I never wanted to be that guy. But at the same time, you know, you're going through this stuff. Prep is hard. Dieting is hard. Cardio is hard. Training is hard. Other things that stress you out come into the mix a little bit. Having somebody that understands what you're trying to do, as your coach certainly does, even if maybe your family doesn't or your friends don't, can be really helpful. And just somebody to hear you out and say, I know, it's all right, cool. And maybe offer a personal anecdote or something like that. That can be super helpful. And you're gonna have a lot of coaches that just simply do not give a shit. And you know what? That's their style. And I'm not going to call them out and say that that is inappropriate because you can't force style on somebody. It is my style. Again, I'm an empathetic dude. You know, it bothers me when people have problems. I try not to make them my own problems, but, you know, I like to feel and understand what somebody's going through at the same time. So of those six roles, once again, educator, strategist, planner, boundary pusher, success facilitator, and therapist. I say therapist kind of like with a little winky face because it's kind of a role, but kind of not. What do you, as somebody who may be looking for a coach, which of those roles do you need fulfilled? What you can do when you're, you know, sending out your emails to inquire about potential coaches, think about those roles and think of questions you can ask that would indicate, you know, if that coach has thought about some of these roles. Like, you know, when it comes to, you know, educator, you know, you can ask, you know, I'm pretty comfortable in the gym, but, you know, I know that details matter. You know, how do you go about making sure that I'm doing stuff right? You know, 'cause that's really important. If you're working with somebody online, they're not there in the gym with you. How do we verify that stuff is happening correctly? That's a big one. Or, you know, explain, you know, I've got some schedule limitations here. I can only do X, Y, and Z. I can lift 4 days a week. Cardio is tricky because, you know, I'm a single parent and I've got three kids and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, what kind of a response do you get when you say something like that? Not like you're looking for, you know, a big round of applause for trying to do this anyway or anything, but, you know, the response that you get from something like that can be very telling. And the response may be something like, well, you're going to have to find a way to get over that. Or it could be something like, well, we might just, you know, knowing that there's time constraints, we may just need to do this for longer in order to get where we need to go. So, and then all coaches are also going to have strengths and weaknesses among these six roles. And if you email a coach, you check out their website, you follow them on social media, it should become pretty clear what their strengths are and where their weaknesses lie. If it's not clear, though, ask them. If there's a particular role that you're concerned about, you know, getting fulfilled in the way that you need, just ask them about it directly. You know, I certainly don't. Again, all these six roles, these are as I see them. So other coaches would be like, you know, therapist, that's not my damn job. I don't give a crap. And again, that's fine. But consider what's important to you, and then know how to ask the questions to identify if the coach that you're considering working with is the right person for you based on those needs. Okay, moving on. This is a good one. So the other main topic that I wanted to cover today was defining what an acceptable risk of injury is when it comes to bodybuilding. The first thing that you have to understand is, you know, what your long-term goal is, and then figuring out how a serious injury or even a minor injury can impact that. So let's say, you know, my goal is to be an IFBB pro bodybuilder, not a physique guy, not a classic physique guy, a bodybuilder. So I'm 6 foot, so I'm probably going to need to be about 250, 260 pounds-ish on stage at a national show if I wanted to be, you know, cut out for that. So that gives me an idea, and I can kind of think about, okay, whoo boy, how much stuff am I going to have to take? How long am I going to have to do this? How much muscle am I going to have to put on per year? And then you can kind of think of, you zoom out, and you're like, okay, that's going to take some number of years. I'm going to have to stay healthy through all that, because I can't afford to lose 4 months because I broke something or tore something or whatever. Now, accidents happen. So, you know, we're not looking to live in a bubble or anything like that, but we need to focus on, you know, defining what an acceptable risk of injury is when it comes to the gym specifically, because, you know, you could be doing home repairs and fall off a ladder and break your leg and you're out for, you know, 4 months or whatever. I mean, anything could happen. But in the gym, it's a controlled environment, so we should be able to define pretty easily what's acceptable and what's not. Now, in a lot of cases, you think about competitive sports, of which, you know, depending on how you define the word sport, bodybuilding certainly classifies as a competitive sport. But things like football, basketball, CrossFit, for example. If you want to compete at a world-class level in one of those, you're going to have to assume some risk of injury. You know, when you're on the football field, for example, you can't say, oh, I can't make that cut because it might blow out my knee. I mean, you're like, you make that cut and your knee will tell you if it's strong enough or not. If you're doing CrossFit, you're like, eh, my shoulder hurts, but I've got to get, you know, I've got to be able to snatch this weight. So whatever, I'm just going to do it. And, you know, hopefully it all goes well. And if not, I'll rehab it, you know, maybe it requires some small surgery, who knows, whatever. But if you're looking to compete at an elite level, you understand in a sport like that, that there is a little bit higher risk of injury that just kind of comes with the territory. And that's to be expected. How bodybuilding differs is that to compete at a high level, there isn't really an assumed risk of injury that's greater than just doing it casually. Just because if you do it correctly, it is very safe. Bodybuilding is a very safe thing. These other things like, you know, CrossFit, basketball, football, even baseball, you get hit in the head with a line drive, whatever. I mean, those are things that have inherent danger mechanisms in them. Bodybuilding does not. If you do it correctly. If you don't, then yeah, you can really, you know, you can do some really bad things. You do a, you know, a reverse grip or a suicide grip bench press, both of which have their merits for sure, but you drop that bar, ooh boy, you're going to have some issues there. So, you know, when you do it right, it is a very safe endeavor. You're not likely to injure yourself. Anything is possible, but the risk is pretty low if you go about things intelligently. So what are some of the wrong things to do? Trying to max out your weight without a spotter or without some kind of a safety mechanism in place is a bad idea. So, you know, as I do a lot more low rep work, higher weight work, I've becoming, you know, acutely more aware of this in the past weeks and months. You know, trying to max out on a bench press, if you're just using like the bench press station at your gym, it's a little dicey without a spotter. And even if you get a spotter, you know, that's another human you're putting into the mix. Do they know what they're doing? Are they strong enough to help you out? You know, if you're that big guy and you're benching 385, you don't want to grab the 150-pound dude who's been in the gym for 2 weeks and ask him to spot you necessarily. So this would be a case where, you know, taking a bench over to the squat rack, setting up the bail-up bars at the appropriate height, it's worth it just because you can push the envelope a little bit and just know that you've got a way out if you need to. I mean, conversely, you could use the Smith machine, although, you know, for a lot of things, it's not necessarily appropriate. So not using the available safety equipment. So, you know, squatting in the rack without having the bailout bars set up, stupid. Even stupider is having the bailout bars set up and taking five giant steps backwards with the bar on your back so you're completely out of the rack and out of the domain of those bars. That is dumb. I see people do it all the time and I'm just like, what are you doing? Part of me almost wants them to fail. But then I realize I'm just not that big of an asshole. But I mean, they would have it coming to them. The idea is you squat, you get the bar on your back, you take one step back, you're still in the rack. You know, those bailout bars are, you know, about 30 inches long usually. You're still within their grasp. So you just make sure they're set correctly. You don't want to hit them on every rep. You want them a little bit lower than your lowest depth on a squat. But make use of them. So use the available safety equipment that's there. The other things that the big things that can really increase your risk of injury, not warming up. How many of us are guilty of that? Raise your hand. I always do a dynamic warm-up before I get started. Dynamic meaning at the start of your workout, you're focusing on movements that force the joints to articulate through various ranges of motion. So, you know, my upper body warm-up will focus on shoulders and elbows. You know, it's a lot of arm circles, overhead stretches, that kind of thing. So I typically spend about 5 minutes or so doing those. And I tell you what, if I don't do that, I'll progress through a shoulder or chest workout and I got a shoulder joint and it's going to start talking to me a little bit. It's not a huge problem. It'll slow me down a little bit. It'll force me to drop some weights. It'll make me think, damn it, I shouldn't have skimped on my warm up. So don't be that guy or gal. You've got the opportunity to warm up before you go. You don't have to spend 15 minutes on it. I see people that go into the stretching room and they do a dynamic warm up and they foam roll and all this stuff. And by the time they start their workout, they've already been there for 25 minutes. That's great. There's nothing wrong with that. Most of us, I don't think, have that kind of time. 5-7 minutes is great, and you can set yourself up for success in a really, really good way if you just give yourself that much time before your workout to go through a proper dynamic warm-up. Another thing that can really be a problem is going too hard too fast. You've got to give your body time to adapt. And so this means whether you're first starting out or you're coming back from injury or illness, like you've been sick, you've been out of the gym for 8 days, you come back, you're like, well, I'm just going to pick back up where I left off. Oh, that's a bad idea. Ease back into it always. I always tell people, you know, when you're coming off vacation or illness or something like that, go in, do a total body circuit. I'll put together a workout that has 5, 6, 7, 8 moves that they can kind of do in a circuit. We're looking for like 50% weights on all these things. Just go in, fatigue the muscles. You're going to feel like you got hit by a bus the next day. You'll want to take a day off and then you should be good to go and ease back in at about 80% after that. If you come back from like a 10-day cruise and you didn't use the weight room on the boat, and then you just hop back into the gym like you never left, ooh boy, that's an injury waiting to happen. So Give yourself the time to reacclimate. Don't go too hard too fast. So how do we minimize the risk? Well, as I mentioned, one thing that you can do is the dynamic warm-up. Just make sure that your body is ready to go. So focus on the joints that you're going to be working. So if it's upper body, that's, you know, everything upper body focuses on the shoulders. So that's always got to be in there. My elbows are pretty happy usually. I will skimp on dynamic movements for the elbow unless I'm doing arms. In that case, I'll absolutely do that. Sometimes, depending on what a back workout looks like, actually more often these days, I will do some elbow warm-up stuff. And that is, you know, a lot of isometric stuff, like just elbow flexion, elbow extension, squeeze the bicep, squeeze the tricep, trying to get a little bit of blood in the muscle and also just get the joint capsule warmed up too. So, stretch afterwards. And this is like the, you know, static stretching, like hold it for 20 to 30 seconds. Once you're done working out, stretch. I would also go so far as to say, if there are muscle groups in your body that you know are tight and you're about to work them, stretch beforehand. It is technically not recommended, but the alternative is to go into a workout tight, and that's not a good idea. And that brings us to my next point, which is greater mobility equals lower risk of injury. So the more mobile your body is, the more fluid and dynamic your muscle and joint movements are, the lower your risk of injury. So that's why we warm up. That's why we stretch, why you should focus on flexibility and mobility. You're going to execute the movements better, and you're less likely to get hurt in the process as well. One question that comes up a lot is about warm-up sets. And my tactic on warm-up sets is every muscle group that you work in a given workout, the first exercise you hit it with, I always do a couple warm-up sets for that group. And if there are big changes in articulation, for example, this is fresh on my mind because I did shoulders today. You know, I do press. I do some lateral raises. I do some reverse flies, and then I'll do an upright row. The upright row is different enough from all those other articulations that I'll do a warm up set or two on that upright row. The shoulder is already warmed up. So what I'm basically doing is just working it for a few reps with some lower weight, just to kind of give the shoulders a chance to tell me if there's anything that feels funky about that. It's kind of like, you know, when you go to a squat rack and you're about to squat, you always start with the empty bar. You know, even if you're going to be working up to 315 or 405, your warm-up weight is not 135. It's not 225. Your warm-up weight is 45 pounds, empty bar every time. Just because, you know, the first time you go down and squat, you know, that's your body's chance to tell you everything feels fine, we're good. Or, boy, you slept on that hip funny. That is not right. You better go back and foam roll that sucker out or something like that. So always start with a very light load initially. Warm-up sets for each new muscle group hit. And if there's a giant change in articulation, then yeah, something like that would be, like if you're doing a bunch of curls, for biceps and then you go into chin-ups, you know, that's a pretty big change in articulation, a big change in grip as well, a big change in the way the bicep is recruited and activated. So, I would go on the assisted pull-up machine, put some weight on there and just do even just like 3 or 4 reps with some assistance on there just to make sure it feels right. And then go into your first working set. Pretty easy, you know, doesn't take a lot of time, doesn't have to be super complicated. My goal, I've been starting lately all of my workouts with some 5x5 work. So today, it was a barbell overhead press, 5 sets of 5. I knew what my first opening set was going to be as far as the working sets. And so I started with, you know, a set of 15 to 20 with just the bar. And then I threw 95 on there and then 115, 135, 155. And then I went up from there and started my first working set. And so all of those other sets, you know, I did high rep on that, just the bar set, that 45 pound set. And all the other weights, I just did 3 or 4 reps. So just getting the body warmed up a little bit, get the blood flowing, get the heart rate up a little bit, not taxing things too much, leaving plenty of work still on the table. You're not trying to fatigue yourself with your warm-up stuff. But you just want to take it in a few jumps just to make sure the body's ready to go. So everything should be slow and controlled. Generally speaking, you should make a habit of avoiding explosive movements. There are always going to be exceptions to that, but if you adopt that as your general rule, you're going to be good to go. If you see those people who do I know you've seen this, they'll do like a wide grip pull down and they'll jerk it back so hard and then the weight jerks them back up and you feel like you're going to turn around and see that the arms have been ripped off their torso. You know what I'm talking about. That is a bad idea. Don't do that. Even if you don't give yourself a serious injury, you're going to aggravate stuff and you're going to give yourself little nagging injuries that just never go away. And they aren't serious enough to require surgery. Those are almost the worst, just because they'll be with you for a long ass time, just because you did something stupid or with bad form or careless or reckless. And it's so totally preventable. The idea behind bodybuilding is to fatigue the muscle. It is not to move as much weight as you possibly can all the time. So all your movements should be slow and controlled. You should feel confident in the way that you execute them, and avoid the explosive movements. Unless, you know, like I've been doing my 3-point row or a one arm dumbbell row. I've been doing those from a dead stop on the ground and a pretty explosive pull, and then a little bit of a squeeze and then a slightly controlled negative. That's the exception. I'd say of all of the stuff that I'm doing right now, all the exercises that I'm doing for all my various workouts in my current split, that's the only one that has any kind of explosive element to it at all. Also, don't overuse your stretch reflex. This is most common on overhead press, bench press, or squat. So squat, you go down that point where you're at the bottom of the squat. You can then use a little bit of bounce up there to help initiate the concentric on the next rep. The bench press, you take the bar down, you touch your chest, you get a little bit of a, again, stretch reflex there. So the muscle gets stretched. The reflex is to get it out of that stretch state. And it gives you a little bit of a boost on that rep. Same thing with the overhead press as well. You overuse or abuse that stretch reflex, it's going to come back to haunt you. So don't do that. Now that does not mean that you have to, on a bench press, bring the bar down to your chest, let it sit there, and then slowly push back up. But just be cognizant of the fact that there is such a thing as a stretch reflex, and don't overuse it. Keep logs. So this is simple. I've talked about this before. I've blogged about it before. Keeping workout logs so you can track your old performance numbers. This will keep you progressing, and it will also keep you from forgetting, like, oh yeah, I've done 185 on my overhead press before. Oh wait, no, I haven't. And so, you know, there's so many numbers involved in all this stuff. It's so easy to forget or misremember. But if you keep workout logs, you've got a record of what you've been doing. You can force yourself to continue to progress slowly and carefully. Lift with your brain, understand, changes in circumstances day to day or over time. When you look back at those old log numbers, you're like, hey, yeah, I did hit 185 on that overhead press. That's awesome. Well, I'm going to hit 190 today, until you think, oh, wait, I'm currently at 800 calories less per day than I was back then, or whatever. Or, oh, actually, I just did chest yesterday, whereas when I hit that 185, I had a day off the day beforehand, or whatever. There could be a lot of factors involved. So just understand that every day is a different day, and don't, we want to progress, but don't force the issue at risk of injury. That's the big thing. And the last thing, and this is the most important thing, so of course I save it for last, ditch the ego. Ditch it. The only thing the ego is going to do is get you hurt. That's all it's good for, is getting you hurt. It does nothing. And I've talked about this many times, how, the weight you move is not nearly as important as how you move it and how the muscle feels when you move it. So focus on that. Don't worry about the weight. Track it, but don't worry about always lifting as much as you possibly can on every exercise. Don't try to impress people. Don't think about who's watching. None of it matters. Nobody's watching. Nobody cares. Focus on you and you alone. Do your thing. So there you go. That's it. So, with any luck, I will be back next week. I have no plans to take another week off anytime in the near future. So we'll plan on meeting back here again next week. So once again, I really appreciate you listening. It means a lot to me. I put a fair bit of work into this, so it's good to know, you know, from some of the feedback that I've gotten from people that it is appreciated. So if you have comments, questions, etc., keep them coming. You can email me directly, Darren@fivestarfitness.com. Find me on Facebook, facebook.com/5starphysique, on Instagram @5starfit, or on the website where you can also email me directly from there, 5starphysique.com. So thanks once again for listening. Appreciate you taking the time to do so. Everybody have a great week, and I will look forward to chatting with you next week.